This work has been was accepted for publication in Journal of Public Health and has been published in August issue. I have copies here if anyone is interested at the end of the presentation. Additionally, I have been asked by another journal to provide additional research on Medicaid population. So if you are interested in learning more about that, I will be glad to meet with you at the end of the presentation. During this presentation, I will provide an overview, an introduction, study objectives and methods, results, discussion, limitations, as well as concluding statements. As we are all aware, EDs are a major source of healthcare delivery in the United States, and during 1996 to 2002, the number of visits actually increased up to 110 million. And in 2003, we have 114 million visits. For all of these years, infectious diseases continue to be a leading cause or leading reason diagnosis at these visits. However, certain population groups, especially blacks and Hispanics, were more likely than whites to identify EDs as a regular source of care. And among those with a regular source of care, between 24 and 36 of their visits, of their most recent visit rather, still occurred at emergency department. That's a big concern. So why do we need to study infectious diseases among this population? At the national level, no studies have documented the profile of infectious diseases in this population. I need to also point out that throughout this presentation, Medicaid and CHIP refers to the same thing, they are combined. One reason why ED data sets have not been widely incorporated is because several states do not have ED system that are computerized. And annually, more than 20 million visits to emergency department relate to infectious diseases. That's a lot. A little bit information about this population. Medicaid in itself is an entitlement program where federal government pays a share of expenditures that are covered that are provided to certain individuals. Under the federal law, individuals must fall within certain categories and they must also meet some financial criteria. In 86, the law requires that as a condition of Medicaid eligibility, individuals declare under penalty of perjury that they are citizens of the United States or nationals of the U.S. or in satisfactory immigration status. Federal Medicaid regulation requires states to also determine eligibility once a year for this population group. And most recently, you're all probably aware of this, most states are still struggling with it. Federal government requires that they must obtain satisfactory documentary evidence of U.S. citizenship or nationality for nearly 40 million non-exempt Medicaid beneficiaries within 1 year, provisions July 1, 2006, effective date. So the objectives of this study were to characterize infectious diseases that are treated in emergency department in 2003, estimate the number of Medicaid enrollees that conducted this visit relating to infectious diseases, as well as calculate visit rates for this population group. The data source is the National Hospital Ambulatory Medical Care Survey, which is conducted every year by NCHS. And the year of study was 2003. As I mentioned, this is a national probability sample survey of hospital emergency departments. And for the year of study, 475 hospitals participated in the survey. And the data are weighted to generate national estimates. For in the intake form that I use, there are two main important variables there that we need to be aware of. One is the patient's complaint, reason for visiting the emergency department. When a patient goes to the emergency department and during the intake form, they ask you what is your purpose or reason of visit. There are up to three reasons for visit that an individual can provide. But there is another variable also, wherein the attending physician provides his diagnosis. The physician can provide up to three diagnoses during the visit. In 2003, a total of 40,253 forms were completed. And the data are coded according to ICD-9, and cases that were selected falling under the infectious diseases was published in the previous research work by Armstrong. For this study, 9 categories were included, and these are listed on the screen right now. For the denominator, for the Medicaid and the CHIP population, because this is not readily available, NCHS requested this, and NCHS provided that information to me. For the U.S., we use the U.S. resident estimates, which is collected by the Bureau of Census. During 2003, there were 21.6 million visits relating to infectious diseases. That figure represents 90% of all visits, and the visit rate for infectious diseases was 76 per 100 per 1,000 per person. Now let's flip the coin to Medicaid population. We have 6.7 million visits relating to infectious diseases for this population, and the visit rate is 200 visits per 100 as compared to 76 for the total population. That's almost the neighborhood of threefold increase. This figure shows the rates by age groups. As we can see, rates were higher for each of the age groups except close to 65. Age group 0 to 14 recorded the most of these visits. And this simply compares the total population to Medicaid group, and I would say that rates were high for the Medicaid population. Similarly, when we compare this by race, see that the Medicaid group also had the highest visit rate. What's interesting here is for the whole population, about close to 70% of visits for infectious diseases were made by white population, but visit rates among black population was almost 33% higher than the white. This table shows the leading causes of leading reasons rather for the visits. As shown, upper respiratory tract infection is the leading cause, as close to half of the visits for the Medicaid fall in this category. And by region, South recorded the most infectious disease visit rates for this population. This is not the first study that will identify South as being problematic for this population group. Upper respiratory tract infection is the most important among the Medicaid population as well as the total visits. We looked at the upper respiratory tract infection also by age group, I found that age group less than 15 years recorded the most visit rates. When we examine this, however, by race, the whites had a much higher visit rate comparison to the black population. By gender, we look at the upper respiratory tract infection also, found that the rate a little bit high among males rather. This is urinary tract infections among the Medicaid group, found that age group 15 to 24, as we will expect, recorded the most visit rates. We must understand that multiple factors influence the rate of visits to emergency departments, and among these included the age, access to care, availability of over-the-counter medications, because some people tend to self-medicate, as well as direct diagnosis at the visit. The 2.6 million visits that is recorded in this research is really very conservative, because there are certain exclusions. For example, military hospitals were excluded. There are implications to this research. This research specifically supports previous studies that describe probable lack of access to primary care providers. Research has documented that for group 25 to 44 years, they tend to continue using EDs as their regular source of care. Skin infections, upper respiratory tract infections, so otitis media and lower respiratory tract infections are the leading infectious disease visits. But come to look at it, this could be treated primary care. Practitioners rather than having to go to emergency department for these conditions. As far as race is concerned, the rate of visit for blacks are much higher than the white population. The reason for the higher rate is really unknown, but we can speculate. Certain reports have indicated that blacks tend to receive less primary and preventive care than the white population. As far as age is concerned, research indicates that infectious disease is a major cause of ED use in both the general population as well as among the Medicaid population. Visit rates was much higher in this group in comparison to other age group. So as far as upper respiratory tract infection is concerned, with more than 80 million visits recorded at emergency department, it is very surprising that the people 2010 objective does not even have an indicator for this condition. So it's going to be definitely hard for us to determine if, in fact, we're making progress, because there is not a benchmark to which we can compare rates to over years, or if you are doing a trend analysis, there's nothing to let you know if you are even making a difference or not. A previous research, which was conducted in Britain, showed that as much as 70% of the visits there relate to upper respiratory tract infections. There are a few limitations to this study. One is we are unable to provide a state level breakdown because due to the collection of the data. And two, we are unable to fully control for racial differences in communities that are surveyed by National Hospital of Medical Care Survey. For example, the inner cities where a majority of the black reside, patients tend to visit EDs. So, in conclusion, the rate of visits for any particular condition is a function of both the incidence of the disease and the healthcare use pattern. This data confirmed previous studies that have shown a possible lack of access to primary care providers and racial inequities. So, Medicaid enrollee specific ED rates were higher by age group, by gender, by race, the region, compared to the national rates, because approximately half of the visits among the Medicaid population relates to upper respiratory tract infection. This should be the basis for any appropriate control measures that could be implemented for the group. Because I work for the federal government, I have to put this disclaimer there that the findings and conclusions in this report are those of the author and do not necessarily represent the views of the Department of Health and Human Services and CDC. Questions? Thanks.
Well, I want to thank all of our presenters and give them another round of applause. We have a considerable amount of time left for questions, so I'll open it up to you all. Does anyone have any questions for our panel? She was asking me to elaborate a little bit on LA Care's existing relationship with community clinics and how they sort of fit in with the school-based health center model. LA Care is really committed to supporting these safety nets, so we have several community clinics in our network. Unfortunately, not all school-based health centers are run by community clinics, although some are. And so I was going over some of those different models in our pilot. Some of the school-based health centers are run by school districts, some by hospitals, and some by community clinics. And so the ones that were run by the community clinics, the majority of those were actually in our network. They fulfilled all of the criteria that the state of California mandates to become a primary care provider site. And so what happened is that at some of those school-based health centers, they actually had some of our members assigned to them, and we were paying a cap rate to the community clinic already. For those members, we didn't reimburse an additional fee for service. They got their cap rate. I think that was one of our goals, but I think when managed care works with school-based health centers, a little bit of that is inevitable. And so our primary concern was that our members are out there, they live in the same communities where these health centers are, and they're actually using them over their PCPs. And so we just wanted to find out how much of an access point these school-based health centers were for our members, and if they are indeed using them, then we wanted to reimburse the school-based health centers for seeing our members. Most of it was financial. I mean, I think I mentioned earlier that there was like 40% of the kids that actually go to school-based health centers are enrolled in Medicaid managed care, but only 10% of the centers are getting revenue from the managed care plan. So this was an opportunity for them to capture some of that reimbursement and add that to their operating cost. Do we have another question? Here.
Just one situation occurs only when it is being billed in the Part B area, that all combination of the antiemetic has to be oral. So at this point, because of the size of our institution, we have just been swallowing it, taking the hit, because they are not all given orally. We prefer to give them IV, except for aprepitant. It is only available oral at this point. And so when it is utilized, we've been taking the hit. Other institutions, I've talked with the institutions that are smaller in size, and this has come up, and when the bill comes back, reimbursement comes back, it's just a one line stating it's been dropped because of the oral, that it is not oral. And they are now forced to actually go to the Part D and try doing a separate billing to see if they will get reimbursed. In our institution, we made the decision as this became an issue to actually see if we can wait it out a couple more months to have that IV aprepitant come on board through the FDA approval, because we are not able to change everything to oral, simply because of the nature of the it's an for antiemetic for patients who are already nauseated, to give them all orally is not going to work at this point. And so because of the size of the institution, we made the decision for this drug. The other example was the ESAs that just going into effect now. We could not make that decision, and so we are giving them ABNs, the advanced beneficiary notice that we're making the patient sign. We're making them sign. Having said that, that doesn't mean they'll end up paying. It's a, you know, greater than 65 age Medicare population. You're telling them this drug costs $2,000 to $3,000 per month. You're signing. Does that mean we'll ever get that money? We don't know. It's not very wide. Actually, we don't use it for this aprepitant. We have not punished the patients for this drug. Where we have utilized it is for drugs that cost in the thousands of dollars. One example is bevacizumab, which is an anti-cancer agent. It's one of the newer agents. And it has one or two indications by the FDA. We use it for all solid cancers. And so... and it is not discussed through the physician-patient at that point. It's actually discussed by the patient and an agent from the business office. And so the physician goes in and says, based on our clinical experience and knowledge, this drug may be useful. But then the other person goes in and says, your insurance, Medicare per se, will not cover this. If you need this, this is the option. And so... well, welcome to the new environment of healthcare in America. I'm not saying it's punishable or not. Yeah, we have everything. The issue is access. And so we did this for bevacizumab. We are now going to do this for the erythropoietin stimulating agents, which is used for anemia, because, again, it is a million-dollar business for us, so there's a certain things we can take the hit on and certain things we cannot take the hit on, so it is being very sparingly used, but it is coming on board as insurance is being denied. At this point, we're writing it off because we think the IV will come on board. The second option we had on the table was to go back and talk to the physicians and change, but there's not that many options available for the very highly emetogenic chemotherapy. And this is very effective as an option, and they can take it home with them. They don't have to come in clinic. It's just the billing pattern is so difficult. No. For part A, everything's bundled.
Right.
You get what you get.
Most chemo
is given on an outpatient basis, and if this drug becomes part of the, or not, or any, if any of the 5-H3 agents become oral, for any of the oral agents to be covered in Part B, the whole combination therapy has to be oral. So if any of them becomes IV, all of them drops out of payment. You can then try it on the outpatient side, except nobody takes it at home. Most of the chemotherapy is in the clinic. And so, yeah, this is an issue. Thank you.
Do we have other questions? Yes, ma'am.
VFC provides vaccines free to the states, to Medicaid programs. However, if the state wants to purchase vaccine on their own, they can obtain the vaccine through the federal contract. So it's not $120 to the state government, but $95 or so. And the VFC, children who are eligible for VFC based upon age, if they are from zero until their 19th birthday. They have to be Medicaid eligible, Native American, Alaska Native, or underinsured for vaccines as well. I don't know what the average reimbursement is. Now, you're talking about for the administration of the vaccine? That's set by each state. I don't know what the average would be.
Your question that if all three of them are IV, there's no problem. Because all the three of the anti-emetic agents are IV, there's no problem with getting reimbursement in Part B. The problem is if one of those agents end up being oral, then all three. And the problem is one of the newer agents we have only exists as an oral form. Yes. For the highly anti-emetic agents, just one doesn't do it. You need 2, 3, 4, 5 combination therapy to hold the patients through. And there is immediate nausea and vomiting, and then there's delayed nausea and vomiting, which occurs 48 hours, 72 hours later. So it's good that they have something they can take home with in terms of a clinical issue. It's just the billing and reimbursement that's a...
Other questions? Okay, well, do you want to leave early for coffee? All right, thanks again.